Satan's envy proves to be completely baseless. Jordan Peterson takes it at face value. And it felt like there was some kind of poetic mirroring there between Jordan Peterson taking Satan's resentment at face value and the fact that Jordan Peterson in his dog whistles is often encouraging his own supporters to feel resentful at liberal society.
So yeah, today I'm very happy to be joined by contributing editor Alex Gorovich. Alex, how are you doing?
Doing great, George. How are you?
Yeah, very, very well, thanks. And both of us are joined today by Orlando Reed. So Orlando teaches English at Northeastern University London and has written for various publications, including Frieze, The Guardian, White Review and Jacobin. And today we're talking about his book, What in Me is Dark? The Revolutionary Life of Paradise Lost. Orlando, thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really looking forward to this one. I'm a bit of a Milton guy, as some people may know, which I think is a good thing nowadays. But yeah, Alex, you wanted to kick things off with a question about the title of the book. Always a good place to start.
Yeah, I suppose just as sort of just basic listener and podcaster education, I was wondering if you could sort of, you know, the book is called What in Me is Dark. I wonder if you could explain where the title comes from and what you think Milton might have been getting at with the title.
Absolutely. Paradise Lost is a poem that is partly famous for its darkness. It opens in hell, where Satan has been sort of imprisoned, cast out of heaven for launching a rebellion against God. And Milton famously describes that environment as containing a kind of darkness visible. It's the poem, the opening two books or two chapters of the poem are full of these sort of scintillating descriptions, paradoxical descriptions of darkness. Famously, Philip Pullman based his fantasy novels partly on Paradise Lost, and his Dark Materials is a quotation from the poem. I took my title from another moment in the opening of Paradise Lost, where Milton is addressing his muse. It's at the very beginning of the poem, and like many poets before him, he's asking his muse to inspire his poem. And he says, "What in me is dark, illumine," by which he means illuminate. And to me, there's an ambiguity there. Is he asking the muse to make light what is dark inside himself? Or is he asking the muse simply to draw that darkness outside of himself and to make it visible to everyone else? So I wanted to use this ambiguity to explain, to make an argument about why Milton's poem has been so influential among later readers over the last 350 years, which is the subject of this book, to claim that it is precisely the darkness, the ambiguity, and the interest in evil and the demonic that has made Milton's poem so influential. So it felt suitable on that basis, but it also made my book sound like it was going to be a confess-all thriller, which I enjoyed the idea of.
Yeah, I think it's also part of the poem where Milton's saying that he, "I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men." This is a very famous, and it's a great opening of a poem where he's like, "Oh yeah, you know, muse, tell me about what happened with Adam and Eve, and oh, by the way, I'm going to justify the ways of God to men," which is a pretty good and an aggressive start, I think.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I mean, so maybe for listeners who haven't read the poem, aren't that sort of familiar with Milton and this particular work of his, I did put down executive summary. I mean, that might lose some of the poetry, as it were, of the poem. But yeah, what happened? What's, you know, because our listeners are very, you know, busy executive types. They need to know the key Cliff Notes version. What happens in Paradise Lost?
Yeah, they only have time for listening to Bunga. Otherwise, everything they do in the executive brief form.
Exactly. On the treadmill. Well, Milton is seeking to justify the ways of God to men. And by that, he seems to mean that he is going to do what the Bible does, to explain God's ways to man. He retells the story of Adam and Eve, their fall from the Garden of Eden. But he tells it in a way that hadn't been, I think, told before, by focusing first on the character of Satan. Satan is a fallen angel, as in Christian tradition, who's been cast out of heaven and down to hell. Paradise Lost opens with his decision to continue waging war against God. And his plan is a kind of guerrilla warfare. He's going to go up to the newly created world and convince the newly created humans, Adam and Eve, to disobey their creator. And that is the means by which Satan is going to get his revenge on God. And so Milton retells the book of Genesis as a kind of revenge tragedy. A revenge tragedy seemingly that has as its hero a failed revolutionary. But then when we get to Eden, it becomes something else. It starts to feel more like a novelistic account of the marriage of Adam and Eve and how it went wrong. And the final movement of the poem, I think of it as having three movements, is after the fall, how Adam and Eve learn to accept their punishment and are prepared to enter the fallen, imperfect world. And it's at that moment that Milton justifies the ways of God to men, because he's answering the question, how is it that an infinitely just and good God could have created a world that's so full of suffering and violence and pain and war and so on? He justifies it by showing us that Adam and Eve are, at the end, content to enter the fallen world.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an extremely good summary. And I guess, I mean, part of the influence of the poem might be because of the, you know, these eternal themes, and we'll get to some of these questions of freedom, of obedience, which you cover in the book. But yeah, I guess I also wanted to. So I only read it a couple of years ago. I don't know why I'd avoided reading it. I probably had some kind of sniffy attitude. It was Shakespeare or nothing, and Milton, and it was all like, oh, if I'm not a Christian, it doesn't apply to me. But I have to just put my cards on the table and say it's probably the best thing I've ever read. I just found it very beautiful, moving, epic, haunting, overwhelming. Passages had to kind of put the book down, and I think that is an experience that I've only had. I'm not a literary critic by any stretch of the imagination, but in reading things like Middlemarch or Anna Karenina or Moby Dick, where there's a whole world there and it's very alive. So if listeners aren't convinced by my 5-star Amazon review, what is a reason that you think, because I hope the listeners will enjoy this conversation and they'll think, actually, yeah, maybe I haven't read this. I'll go and pick up a copy and give it a read. And what's the reason that you think they should give it a go?
Well, I share your feeling that it is the best or one of the best things that is available to us, certainly in English. And it still hits after all of these years. And I've seen that as a teacher teaching it in universities and to adult learners. People just confirm my feeling that reading the whole thing, getting to the end, is an incredibly rewarding experience. One of my friends recently described it as the Mount Everest of poetry. And I thought that's kind of an embarrassing metaphor, because, climbing up Mount Everest at this point, it's been done, but it is as rewarding as climbing a mountain. I think it affords extraordinary vistas across religion, history, contains so much within it that you really go on a journey, an epic journey, just by reading it. And by reading it, you also enter into conversation with 300 years of commentary and controversy and so many great authors, and you can understand works of literature better having read Paradise Lost, not least Middlemarch.
Yeah, I think you know, I guess if listeners haven't read it, we can sort of pause the praise there. But yeah, I think it is one of those. It's funny, like there are some albums you listen to and you realize, like, oh yeah, all these bands that I like are just ripping off this album, and you know, there's a bit of that.
Definitely. But
to move on to, I guess, the kind of the politics, I guess, because I have a question about the past, and then Alex has a question about some more contemporary, you know, valences, I was going to say, or relevance in general. But yeah, listeners might sort of think, oh, why is a, you know, global politics podcast focusing on an old English epic poem about, you know, Satan, Adam and Eve, Garden of Eden, and all that? And I do think the book really clearly makes the case that this is a political poem in the way that it's been read, certainly. But, you know, before we get into some of the reception and some of the kind of the contemporary ways that we could read it, just about the context in which it was written and John Milton himself, who was this guy, and what's, you know, what's significant about the political context in which it's written?
Well, Milton had the both, I suppose, good and bad fortune to be living through the English Civil War, which happened in the 17th century. It's increasingly rarely studied in schools and in universities in England and elsewhere. So it's not so well understood as it once was, but it's sometimes described as the first modern revolution. It predated the French Revolution by 100 years. French revolutionaries saw it as an important precedent. And when it broke out, this civil war between the English king and his parliament, it was clear where Milton's sympathies lied. And in the 1640s, during the first 5 or so years of the civil war, Milton didn't fight in it, but he became a champion of various forms of political and religious freedom, which were really essential values for the parliamentarian side. And when the English cut off the king's head in 1649, Milton was not only given a job in government, he became a civil servant and served for as long as he was able to while that new republic lasted. He was also the go-to political propagandist and wrote various important treatises defending both the decision to cut off the king's head and the cause of liberty, of democratic liberty more generally. And those became very important works of political theory read by later readers like Thomas Jefferson and also Fidel Castro, who refers to Milton in his famous courtroom speech where he says, "History will absolve me." Well, history to some extent has absolved Milton by adopting, since modern society has adopted, many of the values that he himself had championed. He wrote Paradise Lost after the failure of that democratic experiment. The Republic lasted 10 years before it fell apart, and the dead king's son was invited to return. So Milton lived through that period, saw it fail, and it was at that point he seems to have had time to write Paradise Lost, which is full of the emotions, the images, and the arguments of those revolutionary times.
And he's also at this point blind as well, right? So that's another kind of darkness that comes in, and he composes it in his head, and then gets his long suffering daughters to write it out. So yeah, I think there's another kind of, you know, I think that pervades it a little bit, that kind of overturning of hopes and you know, failure and defeat. But yeah, Alex, you had a question here about, you know, yeah. Are we in this situation again, I guess?
Yeah, I was curious because the metaphor of light and darkness and also sort of vision, what we can and can't see, seems to play a pretty heavy role here. And at one level, it's sort of what in me can't I see that I need to? But at another level, and this is sort of the political angle, there's also a different way of thinking about vision, which is a future vision or a vision of a future society that has not yet been realized, or that was for a moment possible, that has been defeated. And in the article that I think you wrote for Jacobin, you argue that this is profitably read as a kind of a poem of defeat, of the defeat of revolutionary aspiration, which is why it's been able to speak to such unexpected people, as
absolutely
Fidel Castro and others. And so I wanted to ask a little bit about that, the sense in which you think it's read as the poetry of political defeat. And then sort of as a follow-up to that, in the article that you wrote for Jacobin, you suggested we can profitably read it in our times in that light. And so I was curious about that, because I could see the analogy. There's a lot of people who sort of think, who have reacted to Trump as a defeat. There's a lot of despair and desolation and demoralization. But I wondered if the point is that it's a general poetry of despair or poetry specifically of sort of defeated revolution. Because it's not clear to me that Trump's election is the end of a revolution, since there wasn't really one happening before it. So yeah, I was sort of curious just to hear more from you about that.
Absolutely. So as you say, Milton wrote the poem in very dark circumstances. He'd seen the political cause that he'd spent his life fighting for fall apart. He'd lost his sight some years earlier. He was widowed, twice widowed, in fact, both of his first two wives had died. And he had three daughters who he was less and less able to provide for, and had a very fractious relationship with them. And he wasn't a very good father, it seems. And it was at a very difficult time that he wrote this extraordinary literary masterpiece. And I think that that's something that countless readers have found so inspiring about Paradise Lost. Not only that it's great, but that it was written by someone who was enduring real suffering. And that fact alone is an important reason for its afterlife. Many other revolutionary thinkers have encountered it at dark times in their lives, such as young Malcolm X, when he was in prison, and have, I think, drawn strength from it as well. It's the extent to which that despair is thematized within the poem is more complex and more interesting, because the defeated revolutionary that we encounter at the beginning of Paradise Lost is Satan. And that begs the very important question, which perhaps we'll get onto in a moment, of whether we're meant to sympathize with Satan. The people talking about what to do about despair in the beginning of this poem are devils, and their solutions, I think, are ones that we're meant to be suspicious about. Sometimes they come up with killer lines that are just impossible to be suspicious about, like Satan says, "All is not lost," which I think might have been a phrase that Milton made up, or at least sort of canonized. Satan talks about the unconquerable will to continue to fight against God. And that's a line that William Wordsworth later repurposed in a poem praising the leader of the Haitian Revolution, Toussaint Louverture, when he was imprisoned by the French. And so Milton's poem leaves us with these poetic riches that can then be read and repurposed by later revolutionaries. So that is partly how we can account for its very rich afterlife over the last 350 years. Later in the poem, we encounter Adam and Eve's fall and their own conversations about despair, and they come up with solutions for despair that I think that Milton would have actually approved of. So we encounter the bad solutions before we encounter the good ones. But it's a poem that's shot through with the question, what to do when you are utterly defeated and there seems to be nothing that you can hope for that would be tolerable. And it's a poem about trying to access that resolution. And that's one of its evergreen messages. To get onto the question of what we're living through today, what defeat, I mean, the left certainly has been defeated, not in the past election so much as just repeatedly in recent decades in the US, but also in the UK. And obviously the liberal promise of Biden and Kamala Harris has been utterly defeated. I think of Trump as being a profoundly revolutionary figure. I don't use revolutionary in my book or when I describe Trump as revolutionary in that sort of sometimes leftists say that the only true revolutionary is a left-wing revolutionary and everyone else is a counter-revolutionary and so on. But Trump is revolutionary, I think, in the sense that he is seemingly breaking up forms of political organization that have been sort of ossified and have been, and some of which have been functioning for decades. So I think what he's doing is the most radical thing to happen in American government in many decades. I don't like it at all, but that's definitely what we're living through. And I think Milton's work really speaks to the politics of today in any number of ways, but mainly in terms of his interest in the psychology of tyrants, in the ways in which arguments about freedom can be perverted and redeployed as arguments for tyranny.
I was glad you said that. You stole the thunder of a follow-up question I wanted to ask you, which was, why not see Trump as the revolutionary figure of the moment? And you mentioned it. And I wondered sort of how far you think the Miltonian interpretation goes, because, you know, as you mentioned, some people read Milton as sympathetic with Satan. Part of his revolutionary sympathies are satanic. And one version of that argument goes something like, revolutionaries always appear in the form of the devil, because what are they if they're not subversive? What are they if they don't look ogreish, cruel, immoral, the transgressors of what is understood to be the appropriate and proper and moral way of behaving?
Yeah, I agree with that.
That is something that people say about Trump in particular. But this leads us to the slightly sort of, I wonder how far you want to go, but both with Milton and its application to the present on this point. Is it meant to be a warning to us that revolutionaries always appear in satanic form? Or is that just our inability to recognize their revolutionary character because we're still stuck in the institutional morality of the status quo?
I share your sense of this. I think William Blake famously claimed that Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it, because his revolutionary Satan speeches are so moving and also so close to the things that Milton had written himself as a political theorist. I think Blake is making that argument precisely for the reasons that you outline, from that sense that there's no way of being radically emancipatory within a society without seemingly violating its most deeply held moral norms. And so that any revolutionary or radical has to accept the fact that they will be demonized in their own lifetime. I think that's a kind of tragic irony to some extent. I don't agree with Blake that that's what Milton is doing, although I love his interpretation. I think what Milton is doing is giving us, there's a grand temptation in Paradise Lost, and that is to sympathize with Satan because he sounds so revolutionary. He's making all of these very appealing arguments about freedom. But if you read all the way to the end, in the very last book or chapter of Paradise Lost, Milton really clarifies why Satan is not a revolutionary, why Satan says that God is a tyrant because God is the sole ruler of heaven. So, you know, surely Milton, who is an enemy of tyrants, couldn't espouse a theology in which there was one solitary ruler who passed on power to his son. Milton later clarifies that. And I think you have to read all of Paradise Lost in order to understand how to resist that temptation. So Blake's interpretation might hold for the first couple of books, but not if you read the whole thing closely. That's my somewhat conservative analysis of it.
No, I think there's definitely something in that, because Satan starts off, you know, pretty strong, having been defeated, and then saying things like it's better to reign in hell than serve in heaven, and you're like, yeah, can definitely get behind this guy, but doesn't necessarily end up being fully sympathetic. To come at this kind of, I guess, question of contemporary sort of relevance from a different angle, you wrote a piece in The Nation about epic masculinity. Yeah, how do you think Milton can help us And we're kind of like, this is like read Milton, not as self-help, but as a kind of a way to understand the present. But, you know, is there anything that we can take from this, you know, 17th century poet that still sort of applies to today in this area?
I do think that it has some analytic power, the poem, if only to show us that some of the things that we're living through have been happening for a long time, some of the political machinations. It is important to try and, you know, hold different historical periods apart, but sometimes there are simply survivals that forms survive into the present. So in the piece in The Nation, I was talking about how three prominent right-wing figures, Elon Musk, Jordan Peterson, and Peter Thiel, were instrumentalizing their own readings of epic literature, both to show off that they are learned, intellectually energetic men, but also to articulate, I claimed, a kind of ambitious new right-wing thinking. I wrote it a few months before the inauguration, and I think its analysis has been borne out by the tenor of this new administration, which really is putting a strong emphasis on innovation, on ambitious projects, and on warlike rhetoric. But the responses to the article have been quite funny from various right-wing publications. One in the Free Press, Barry Rice's website, there was an essay called All Men Want to Be Heroes, which was seemingly a response to my essay, but the guy decided that what I was saying was that men shouldn't be heroes, and that's what I had taken away from this. But I think what that response made me see is that the epic is still relevant to our times, because epic poems are stories of human actions at their most consequential. That's Aristotle's definition. And what are political projects if not attempts to elevate human action to their most consequential? So it may be the case that the epic genre reemerges at moments of a special political ambition. And my feeling is that the left needs to contest the right's monopoly on the epic. That might be something that we've relinquished in recent decades, thanks to the kind of postmodern suspicion about grand narratives and so on. But if that is the case, I do think that we should be energetically contesting that monopoly, because epic stories are fundamental to who we are as humans.
It's interesting you bring that up, that the need for the left to recover some sense of the epic, because it reminds me of that, I don't remember where Hegel says it exactly now, but that somehow the epic is incompatible with modern life as sort of bourgeois society and the ordinariness of commercial interaction and the kind of stabilization of the nation state make any kind of heroic achievements seem incompatible with the basic sort of objective institutional structures of life, as well as a model for how one might live. I wonder what you think of that judgment, especially in light of what you said about the left and the right's epic.
Yeah, well, I think it's a really important claim, it being Hegel. But on some level, he's right that the societies that had oral traditions, that passed heroic stories through oral performances, had largely been superseded, at least in some parts of the world, by the printing press and by different forms of transmission. So on some level, it seems to me, undoubtedly correct. However, even today, there's plenty of evidence of the desire for epic stories. Marvel films, or even films, somewhat more complex films like American Sniper, heroizing US military deeds and these heroic veterans returning from war. I think that's evidence of an epic tradition. It's not epic poetry as in the way that Homer composed it. there's a kind of funny version of Hegel's claim made by James Joyce, where he said modern policing renders epic barbarism impossible, something like that. But only a couple of years later begins work on Ulysses, which is a strange kind of epic, but it's undoubtedly an epic. I do think that the modern epic, which is a phrase invented or elaborated by Franco Moretti, the modern epic is a more complicated work of literature. Its heroes are not necessarily unambiguously heroic, or even more ambiguous than Ulysses is in the Odyssey. Milton already is quite queasy, I think, about straightforward heroism, and that's why I find Paradise Lost so interesting, that it seems to be contradicting itself, an epic poem that actually doesn't represent that much heroic fighting, and none of it by human actors.
No, it's actually a really good point. The kind of the epic battle has just happened, and Satan and co have just been thrown down into hell. I did want to ask, because we talked quite a bit about Milton and the poem, but about your book specifically, because it provides a roadmap of some of the readers of Paradise Lost over the years, from Thomas Jefferson and Dorothy Wordsworth to George Eliot, Virginia Woolf, Hannah Arendt, Malcolm X, C.L.R. James, just to name a few, and Jordan Peterson as well. What did you want to, communicate to the reader by kind of through this selection of readers of this poem?
I gathered these readers over a period of years, and they were mostly people who I was interested in for various reasons. If someone is an ambitious reader alive between 1700 and about 1950, then the chances are they've read Paradise Lost. So I had a pretty wide pool to select from. Mm. I wanted to start with Thomas Jefferson because he's one of the most straightforwardly political readers of Milton. He was continuing the Republican project, radicalizing it, but continuing it, and saw himself as continuing in Milton's footsteps only about 100 years after Milton had died. So that felt like the natural starting point. Then Dorothy and William Wordsworth, who were living through the French Revolution, and then the Baron de Vatay living through the Haitian Revolution. So I start with these three revolutions, American, French, Haitian. And then it gets a bit more complicated. And I go to George Eliot, and I think about her as continuing a tradition that Dorothy Wordsworth was working in, and later Virginia Woolf taking up that tradition of thinking about women's writing as an expression of a kind of emancipatory feminist project. I also think about abolitionist readers in the United States. And so it's quite a Catholic understanding of what it means, what a revolution is and what it means to be a revolutionary reader. But once it gets into the 20th century, it becomes more eclectic. And I suppose in some ways that reflects the political eclecticism of the West in the 20th century. Hannah Arendt is this curiously ambiguous liberal conservative emigre who's married to a former communist, but parroting sort of CIA type propaganda. And then Malcolm X is a nascent, not yet a black nationalist, more kind of unorthodox black Muslim. And C.L.R. James is a sort of post-Trotskyist socialist agitator. The part of the fun for me was thinking about these different personalities, how their personalities related to their politics and how their interpretations related to both of those things. Jordan Peterson, I wanted to bring in as a kind of curveball, partly to challenge the fact that many left-wing people that I know and many that I follow online are quite intolerant in their reading practices and wouldn't read Hannah Arendt and would perhaps dismiss a book that even had a chapter on Hannah Arendt, let alone Jordan Peterson. And so I think to some extent I was being mischievous by including Jordan Peterson alongside these genuinely great figures. I do find him very compelling, and I perhaps wasn't as open about that in the book as I should have been. I wanted to try and dispatch him as quickly as possible. But I do think he's in there because he does something that I find intellectually very engaging.
So what do you think he gets out of Paradise Lost? Why, because we talked already about the epic and, you know, that could be an appeal, but is there some other, I don't know, how does he get from reading Paradise Lost to kind of tidy your room and kind of sit up straight in the other rules that he gives for life?
Well, his psychology is based on a fundamental distinction between two sort of Jungian archetypes. On the one hand, the hero's journey is elaborated before him by Joseph Campbell, who says, you know, you should just think of yourself as a hero and your life as a hero narrative. Jordan Peterson takes that, and I think one of his main innovations within this quite weird Jungian tradition is to say, is an ethics, actually, a psychology and an ethics. On the one hand, here is the psychology and the ethics of the hero, and to this we have to oppose the adversary. And he admits that his access to the figure of the adversary, Satan is the Hebrew word for adversary, is in Paradise Lost because Satan isn't really that coherent a figure in scripture. So Jordan Peterson reads Paradise Lost and he, in a kind of humble brag, says, I read and perhaps understood much of Dante's Inferno and Milton's Paradise Lost, and a third thing, maybe it was Goethe's Faust. But I found that when I looked at his use of Paradise Lost, he hadn't really understood something about Paradise Lost, and that is that Satan's rebellion in heaven, the whole cause of his envy against God, is that Satan believes that God has promoted his own son, who is a kind of Christ figure that hasn't yet been born as Christ, that God has elevated his son above the angels. And Satan is angry about this because he is one of the upper class angels, and he thinks that he has been hard done by. He's been passed over for promotion. But if you read Paradise Lost closely, it becomes clear that God promoted the Son because the Son was always already part of God and wasn't one of the angels, was in fact the person or the agent that created the angels in the first place. So Satan's envy proves to be completely baseless. Jordan Peterson takes it at face value. And it felt like there was some kind of poetic mirroring there between Jordan Peterson taking Satan's resentment at face value and the fact that Jordan Peterson, in his dog whistles, is often encouraging his own supporters to feel resentful at liberal society.
Interesting. I think that it comes through in I think a lot of the chapters that there are a number of different ways to read this. Maybe that is this poem, and maybe that is the case with all great literature. It contains so much and it's contradictory with itself that you can read it in so many different ways and read it again and again and get different things out of it. I did just have a quick follow-up before moving to the question of freedom that we really wanted to zoom in on a little bit. Just for listeners, what did Malcolm X get out of the poem? Because I think this is an interesting chapter, and you know, a reader that I wasn't expecting to see. And I think the way that you laid it out, these three revolutions, you can see, you know, the American, French, and Haitian. You can sort of see how people could read this poem there. But he has a bit of an unorthodox, even within the wide range, I think, of readers that you have in the book reading A Paradise Lost.
Yes, he does. He was given a long prison sentence when he was in his very early 20s for burglary. And once inside, he quite quickly started giving himself an extraordinary self-education, really devouring literature, philosophy, history, even before he converted to the Nation of Islam. But after he converted, after he had this life-changing conversion experience, that only intensified his desire for knowledge of the world. But he started reading in a more suspicious way. So he would sort of turn texts upside down, try and find the secret buried truth to make them compatible with his religion. And to some extent, that's what he does with Milton. He notices in Paradise Lost that Satan is often compared to a figure of worldly authority, and often, strikingly, those are European authority figures, like the King of Spain sending ships across the Atlantic to the New World, or merchant ships going to far-flung places to trade spices and precious commodities. And Malcolm X, I suppose, interpreted these metaphors as a kind of radical critique. That's my interpretation anyway. And I don't think he was entirely wrong in doing so. I do think that sometimes Milton makes these comparisons, Satan being compared to the king of Spain, and there is a kernel of radical critique in there. On the basis of this connection, Malcolm X concluded that Milton and his own guru, Mr. Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, were in fact saying the same thing, that they were both saying that European colonialism and white supremacy were driven by demonic urges. So that's, I think, an extraordinary conclusion. It's been largely dismissed by Milton scholars. No one had ever really looked into it very closely before. I didn't think that they had sort of accorded Malcolm X the sort of intellectual richness or attention to detail that he deserved. And in looking into it, I found that there was actually a connection between Paradise Lost, the story of Paradise Lost, and the Nation of Islam's famous origin myth about the black scientist called Yaqub, who invents the white race. In various of its tellings, this origin myth actually does sound quite a lot like the story of Satan and being kicked out of heaven. So in my reading, I attempted to kind of restore to Malcolm X the dignity of his interpretation, but also to claim that when he tells the story about his young encounter with Paradise Lost, he tells it in his autobiography, written at the very end of his life, at a time where he was proposing a new black revolution that would in some ways fulfill and complete the American Revolution. He told the story about reading Milton as a kind of epic boast within his own kind of heroic journey.
No, I just think it's very, because I guess my sort of understanding of readers of Milton, you already mentioned Blake and William Blake and his idea that Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it. And then you have Marxist historian Christopher Hill saying that's not quite right. In fact, he was of the devil's party, but he did know it. And the reason for this is that Satan gets all the best lines. And that's the kind of very, not like a detailed literary reading, but all the romantics then, you know, to various different degrees. And this is a generalized kind of fall for Satan and think like this is a, you know, what a model of kind of doomed principle. And particularly at the beginning of the poem, as you rightly said, it gets a bit, if you listen to the whole album, the later tracks kind of speak against some of the early ones. But yeah, to get onto, I guess, some of the, or maybe the big question about freedom, Alex, I think you had something you wanted to in here.
Yeah, I did. I wonder, I mean, if this is a poem written by someone sympathetic to revolution and who is in some sense himself a revolutionary, and there is this idea that all modern revolutions are in some way about freedom, then I wonder, and Milton's claimed for the kind of Republican Party, the small r Republican Party, not American Republican Party, just to avoid any confusion. Then a question for me is what notion of freedom you think is at work, if any, in this poem? Because is it fundamentally about sort of self-awareness? Is it the achievement of a kind of self-knowledge as freedom? Or is it, I mean, you've suggested, and George just brought up again, that if you read all the way through, part of the story, the poem is learning to resist temptation. The reason Satan gets all the best lines is to recognize the temptation, but that ultimately to not side with Satan, to instead be able to overcome actively, not just become aware of in some sort of epistemic sense or whatever, or theoretical sense of one's of the darkness within, but to be able to rule it. So there's a kind of notion of self-rule. if that's a certain idea of freedom in it, and if so, how that's connected to something more explicitly or obviously political in terms of sort of freedom as some way in which we relate to others. So I wonder if you have a thought about this, or is this is sort of trying to read a external preoccupation too deeply into the poem itself?
No, not at all. I think liberty is the central term in this book, alongside perhaps temptation. But we are only tempted by something because we have the capacity of free will to choose or not to choose. What makes Milton's account of freedom somewhat alien to a modern understanding of freedom is that it's a religious term first and foremost. In writing Paradise Lost, he's weighing into this argument that had preoccupied many Protestant theologians for most of the 17th century, and that is the debate between Calvinists and Arminians. And Calvinists, as you guys no doubt know, believe that people are sorted into saved and damned before, not only before they were born, but before the beginning of the world. God sort of sorts them into two boxes. And Arminians questioned the morality of that and suggested instead that free will and the capacity to make good decisions was central. This was a worry for Protestants because once you start talking about free will and good decisions, you're coming a bit too close to the Catholic idea of good works. But Milton was an Arminian, and in Paradise Lost, God is very clear that he is giving Adam and Eve free will in order to make the decision whether or not to obey him. And that concept of free will is sort of grafted onto the political, because Milton believed in democracy because he thought that a body of free-born male citizens using their reason and their free choice would come up with better ideas and come to better decisions than a state ruled by a single hereditary ruler. And so the religious liberty and political liberty are taken to be continuous with each other. To respond to your really interesting point about temptation and obedience, I suppose Milton in Paradise Lost is dramatizing the fact that when we're presented with a choice of whether or not to do something, when we're told not to do something, it can feel far more like an expression of our freedom to disobey. To eat the apple feels like, you know, a classic, an iconic expression of freedom. But the more perhaps counterintuitive or just subtle account of freedom that Milton offers us in Paradise Lost is that there's no unfreedom in obeying good law and a good ruler. And so the one law that Adam and Eve were given in Eden was obviously for their own good. And had they understood that to obey a good law was also an expression of their freedom, well, they wouldn't have made a better decision. But it's important for Milton's sake to insist that Christians who are serving God's will are not giving up their freedom. They are, in fact, expressing it in its best way.
I think that's a really I hadn't quite grasped that on reading it. I think my sympathies lie with Eve fundamentally. That thirst for knowledge. I guess maybe there is another element or level to this freedom, or the challenge of that kind of understanding that you can have freedom in obeying the law is really difficult without self-awareness, without knowledge, without eating the apple. And that is if you eat the apple, you know that you shouldn't have eaten the apple. If you haven't eaten the apple, you don't have the knowledge of good and evil. So I don't know. And I don't know if there is that element to it as well, but I do feel like I want to stick up for Eve, you know, to fall upwards into knowledge out of Eden. It would be nice to still be there, but you know, we've got more complex problems now.
I do agree. Milton might object that God sends down the angel Raphael to give them an education in the hope that Raphael's story that he tells them about Satan will give them the information that they need so that they don't actually need the apple they don't need to eat the apple to be aware of why it's a bad idea. But the human truth, which is that it's often impossible to learn your lesson other than through experience itself, suggests, unfortunately, that not only Raphael's story, but literature in general is powerless to stop us from making bad decisions.
And I guess that importance of experience, this is probably not unrelated to William Blake's reading and, you know, the relationship between innocence and experience. And, you know, I guess it is, you know, that is one of the tragic aspects of the poem, and I guess of human life as well. But we've just to wrap this up and move towards the ending of, because before we was recording, I asked you kind of what's your favorite bit, and you said about the ending, and I was saying, well, we don't spoil the ending for our listeners who might not have read it. But yeah, what do you make of the ending of the poem? What do you think it kind of signifies, or what meaning does it give to the preceding lines?
Yeah, well, this relates to the point that you just made about William Blake as well and his ideas of innocence and experience. As I understand it, William Blake really wanted to embrace the idea that an experienced life that was one of suffering was preferable to an innocent life that had no experience attached to it. To some extent, he gets that from Milton, but I think William Blake has a rosier view of it than Milton. The ending of Paradise Lost, my favorite part of the poem, but I think my favorite piece of literature in general, gives us a vision of Adam and Eve leaving the Garden of Eden, walking out hand in hand. And I think it's right that we don't read it aloud. It's so beautiful, but it would feel somehow pornographic to give people a kind of taste of that without having done the hard work to get there. But it's an extraordinary moment because it's both sad and kind of minimally optimistic. Adam and Eve are resolute. They're walking out together. They've had lots of arguments, but they have been reconciled. And it's beautifully, I suppose, it seems strange to call it realistic, but the feeling is one of realism. There's nothing rosy about this vision. Yeah. They're going to go out and suffer. They know they're going to suffer, suffer in childbirth, suffer through the need to work. They're going to die. Their children are going to die. And yet they have come to understand that it's still worth living. It's still worth living in this world where they're going to suffer. And I think that's a beautiful idea because I also believe it to be true. Easy for me to say in the privileged Western world, but I do think that reading and thinking about Paradise Lost has helped me to understand that no matter the suffering that happens in the world, that we're all making decisions on a practically daily basis to remain alive, because on some level we share Milton's intuition that to be alive is a basically good thing. The last thing I'll say about the ending of Paradise Lost is that the novelist, English novelist Kingsley Amis, recommends them as a hangover cure. But I think that you have to read the first 10,000 lines to get the full effect.
Well, what a great note to leave it on. And Kingsley Amis knew something about hangovers for sure. So yeah, and just to recommend the book again, and we did just listeners, if you want to hear why maybe Blade Runner could be a cinematic adaptation of Paradise Lost, check out Orlando's book. But Orlando, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.